Functions happening all over the place that we just don't need to get into because I'm almost at that age. I mean, I only got a few more years and I can actually be a senior citizen, you know, which is going to be kind of fun. I'm looking forward to it, going around pushing young people out of the way.
Hitting them with your shopping cart.
Yeah, hit them with my shopping cart. Drool on myself a little bit, cross my eyes, and they're just going to go, oh, look at the doddering old guy.
And drive with my blinker on.
Yeah. I did that the other day because I forgot. I went to change lanes and it didn't cut off. And I forget what I was, you know, just driving. I got about like 3 miles and I'm like, oh, idiot indicator. Yeah, that's odd for me. That's not a blinker. That's an idiot indicator. All right. Fish and Frank in the chair. Robert in the chair across from me. And RJ in the control booth. How's the sheephead doing up at Placida, Robert?
Actually been doing really good. This cold weather kind of turned them on even more so. All of last week I was getting better and better reports, but with this cold front, seems to have really kicked them off, because before it was mostly hearing about them on the flats and along the mangroves and some of the oyster bars, but they started to pile back in onto the trestle there and at the Tom Adams Bridge and also up in the Venice jetties. So a good definite mixed gamut of it, and size wise too. You know, some guys are catching some fish up to 16-17 inches long.
It's now that doesn't sound big, boys and girls, but when you consider the height of a sheephead, this is a fish that looks more like a dinner plate, and apropos because it's a very good eating fish, kind of tough to clean, but very, very good eating fish. But it's tall, it's not exceptionally wide, you know, it's not round shape, it's kind of, you know, platter shaped.
Right.
But fits because it goes on a platter really well.
Yeah.
But if it's 17 inches tall, it's probably 12 inches, you know, 17 inches long. It's probably 12 inches high.
Oh, yeah, easily.
Easily, maybe 14. I mean, they're almost as long as they are tall.
Yeah. Yeah, they're so pretty good fish.
If you have a 17-inch fish that, you know, is more cigar-shaped, it's not exceptionally large fish, but with a sheephead being so tall and then kind of get broadside to you when they're pulling, and so you're dragging a lot of fish through the water, probably almost twice if the amount of resistance as a normal 17-inch fish. You're almost trying to pull in a 30-inch fish as far as, you know, water resistance, pulling power.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they like to turn sideways while you're fighting them. You know, on top of being around structure, makes it even more of a challenge, because that's, you know, when they get around those pilings, they know to swim towards them to escape, just like any other predator.
Well, if a fish, when they're little and something big goes to try and eat them, they try to play ring around the rosy around the piling. So yeah. Anytime they get scared, they've learned to just run around an object and maybe avoid the predator, because if you take off in a straight line, the big one's going to eat you.
Yeah.
But if you can go around in circles and play ring around the rosy around a piling, you're going to live.
Yep.
And so as soon as you put the hook in and they start feeling the fight, their first thing is it's not so much a fight as an escape. They want to run away from whatever's happening to them, so they're pulling to get away. And first instinct, run around and around and around the piling. So you don't have a lot of time. When you hook one of those big sheephead, you've got to get them turned towards open water, get them away from that piling, get them moving. You know, you got to get control. And that's why it's hard if you have a real bendy rod.
Yes.
If you don't have to have a real heavy rod, but a tighter action, something that as you pull down on the tip, every inch the rod bends, it increases the pressure against the fish. Rather than a lot of these rods, they kind of bend almost to the middle with no difference at all. And as far as how much weight it takes to get that far. And then you've got that last bit of the rod where it's real heavy, but by then the fish is already wrapped around the pilings.
Oh, yeah.
So what you're looking for is not a heavy weight on a rod, but a tight action. Something with a faster taper tip, like Stellar Light 8 to 17 would be a good one for that,
mm-hmm.
because it's got a little bit of tip on it, so you get that little bit of flex. You can kind of feel the bite. But as soon as that fish starts pulling down on it, it starts getting harder and harder to bend. Every inch, it gets more difficult to put a bend in that rod.
Right. If you're standing on the pier, you don't want your fishing rod tip to be touching the water.
Exactly, because as that rod bends too much, if that tip bends very easy for 2 or 3 feet, that's 2 or 3 feet for the fish to run around the piling with.
Yeah. Yeah, so you need something stiffer action. And honestly, for me, standing on a pier, I actually like one that's a little bit longer rather than like a 6.5 or maybe a 7 foot rod. I like to use a 7.5 or an 8 foot rod because I can kind of lift my arm out and over the railing pointing out towards the open water to give me a little bit more leverage to pull them away from those pilings.
So you're using a longer rod so that from the tip, there's more of an angle out away from the dock.
Correct.
The shorter the rod, the more straight up it is.
Right.
The longer the rod, the more of an angle away from the dock it is. So you can literally pull them out away from the piling while you're trying to reel them in and fight them rather than letting them, you know. And we sell a ton of ugly sticks, but they come in a lot of different varieties. And the older, more original variety ugly stick kind of bent very easily all the way to the middle of the rod. It was made for
almost all the way to the handle.
Almost all the way to the handle, yeah. And they were great for open water fishing. If you were in a boat and you're casting out, fighting a fish, they were awesome for that because you're almost impossible to break. But that bend didn't matter when you have open water because right. the fish could go away and come back at you. But once you get around the pilings, that kind of bendy rod is going to cost you a lot of fish.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and like you said, ugly stick has kind of gone away from just the one model. Now they've got all sorts of different models where you can actually get some of them that have that tip action. Now they're no longer that indestructible rod because they've got so many different models. But you can, you know, if you favor that.
You can still get the older indestructible versions.
Absolutely.
And it literally, if you're out in a small boat and you just want a rod that's going to be very, very strong, not wonderfully nice, but just really tough, it's a great rod for open water.
Absolutely.
But it's not the rod I'm going to pick. I would like it on the pier, because first thing I do with a pier rod is I want one that can fall over, hit the concrete, bounce off the railing, and not break.
Right.
I would not want to take a Reaper or a Star Seagis or, you know, some of these higher $150, $200, $250 rods. The more expensive a rod is, the less I'm likely to use it on a pier.
Correct.
It's money you just threw away, because as soon as you lay that rod down and you're on the pier, I guarantee you're going to set that rod down. And then it's going to fall over, and you're going to shatter it, break the tip, or it'll fall over. You won't, oh, no, it's fine. And you go to land a fish, and the tip of the rod falls off. And you think, what did I do? I was just reeling in a fish. What was that? Bang, you hit on the concrete with it, or when it hit your tackle box before it hit the concrete.
Yeah.
That's when that rod actually broke. You just couldn't see it.
Yeah, that hairline fracture is next to impossible to see on a very high modular graphite rod.
Yep, absolutely. Now, RJ, you prefer on the piers longer rods, shorter rods? What's your...
I'm going to go with the wisdom of the El Jobin Pier.
The wisdom of the El Jobin
Pier. You look at the guys that are actually bringing the sheep head in. You know, they got them in the buckets and
right.
they're carrying, and they're all carrying boat rods with like a Penn Senator or a Del Mar or something like that. So they got these short, stiff rods.
No action.
No, I mean, you're fishing with a broomstick, basically.
Rip it and rip it.
Exactly right, and that's what they're doing. The sheep's head will hit, and they'll do like Robert says, these guys will stick their arms way out to keep it away, and they'll reel like crazy, and that seems to be the best. The guys out there with the spinning reels, all you hear them is the F word as the line breaks from being wrapped around one of the pylons.
Now, I can do it with a spinning rod, no problem, but it's just matching the right type of spinning rod to the job.
It's right.
Like I say, when guys are out there and they're using a rod that's great for fighting a fish, awesome for fighting a fish. You get a lot of fun. It bends.
Yeah, yeah. It bends. It pulsates. You're having a great time.
It's wonderful. But that's not a close to the pure heavy structure type rod.
No, definitely not. And also, if you're grocery fishing, you got to go with what brings in the best groceries and the most groceries. And like I said, you're fishing with the old broomstick type rod is the way to go.
Now, I would go out when I was tournament fishing, and I used to fish a lot of tournaments. And some of the tournaments would allow you to wade fish. Well, I would put like 50, 60-pound test, and this is when braided line was first coming out. I put like 60-pound test braid on my little short. It was just a little less than 6 foot long. I had a rod that broke. I re-tipped it. Awesome, powerful rod. And with that 60-pound braid, I would walk right on the drip edge of the mangroves looking in to see where the redfish were. In my mind, as I walked along, I would picture a herring or a stork as they walk along, and you got to take those real slow steps, and you got to look in the water because you're literally looking to see a fish laying there. And then I would just take the bait very, very, very slowly, put the tip of the rod right into the trees, set the bait in front of the fish, and when he bit, I would just lift him right through the branches. Mm. I wasn't worried about fighting him out. I would just, once he was hooked, I had everything locked up. I just cupped the spool. I would lift up, and literally like cane pole fishing. Yeah. And I would pick those redfish right out of the bushes with it. Meanwhile, my buddies were out there casting at the mangroves, not really seeing if there's a fish there or not, and trying to bring them in from from underneath the mangroves. Well, the fish are wrapping the branches, doing this, because they got like 15-pound test on. Well, if I'm fishing a tournament or I'm on a dinner and there's no rules against it, by God, I'm loading it up.
Well, and that's the way it is when you're fishing. You're fishing for money or you're meat fishing. I mean, these guys aren't concerned about the fight. And a lot of those guys at Eljabeen, I mean, sheep's head are not really known as like a game fish status. So where you're just catching them for fun and fighting them, even though they do put up a wonderful fight. The majority of the people who are targeting those are strictly targeting them for the grocery part of it because, you know, they're different than the animals up north that they call sheephead. These fish are actually super, super edible. You know, they're phenomenal eating.
Well, I like the guys with the little aluminum boat, and there'd be three or four of them in a 12-foot boat, and they'd have shark rods, Penn Senator 4-0s on a shark rod, 80-pound test with a hook on the end catching whiting.
Yeah.
And a big, big whiting is, what, 2.5 pounds?
Oh, that's a giant one,
That's a giant one. Most of them, I'd say, go from a half a pound to a pound.
Right.
And they're out there with the big shark rods because they ain't going to lose that fish. They weren't getting that dinner out of it. Well, either that or just too cheap to buy a second rod.
Well, that's part of it. But, I mean, and some of them get frustrated because they're using 60-pound mono or even 80-pound mono because that's what's on their shark rod. And then they can't find a hook that's small enough with a big enough eyelet to put that leader
that's
through.
That's why they go to the Eagle Claw Snelled hooks.
Right.
You can get through the Snelled hook.
You got a good point that most of them do buy that.
Yeah.
I had a guy that wanted this specific hook last year, and he was convinced that they made it, but he wanted an eyelet twice the size of that.
Right.
It
was like, that's when you go over to the Eagle Claw section or to the Angler's Choice, and you got those big old Snelled hooks over there, and here you go, buddy. I guarantee your line will fit through this eye.
Yep, absolutely.
A half-inch rope will fit through it.
Yeah.
All right. The number one question we have had and the number one confusing point over this last month, and it kind of really came in this week. I bet you we've had 20 people in this week. Oh, we're staying at a house. We just bought a house. We rented a house. And we're on brackish water. What do we do?
Yeah.
And it's the term brackish that's making them crazy. They literally don't understand what it means. I think somewhere people have brought it into legend and myth that it's a separate type of water. It's not fresh water, it's not salt water, it's something special and unique all unto its own. It's ba 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 ba.
Well, and it kind of is, because you said it before. We wouldn't be able to afford to live here if the water was like the Keys.
That's true. Now, but I love the old brown water. Now, RJ,
the brown water allows us to do that.
What do you think of when you brackish water? What do you think it means?
Well, when I lived up north in Connecticut, New York, Long Island area, and you fished the inlets and the small streams and stuff coming in, you always thought that brackish water was like part salt, part fresh. It's not clean as salt like the fresh water is. It's not all salty like the Sound would be. It was somewhere in between. And there was always, you were targeting species that you figured could live in both the salt and the fresh side of it. I think here in Florida, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever.
I think you were targeting it right exactly on the money with what you first said. There is no such thing as brackish water in the eyes of law enforcement. Law enforcement looks at saltwater and or freshwater. There is no brackish water in the eyes of the law. You're either fishing in saltwater or you're fishing in freshwater. You do not get the option of saying, oh, I'm in brackish water, I can do this. No, that is not true. Now, in Southwest Florida, US 41 from most of its length is the dividing line between fresh and saltwater. In Port Charlotte and in Northport, if you're east of US 41 on a canal, it's 99% or to 100%, depending if we count just a few feet, that's freshwater, east of. West of, it is saltwater. Now, there is a couple little exceptions, but let's say the 99% rule. State law in Florida is every water that crosses US 41 has to have a dam on it. Keeps the freshwater on the east side, the saltwater on the west side. Now, the Peace River is not dammed off. Myakka River is not dammed. The Caloosahatchee has a lot of locks and dams, but not right there. So these three are out of the running for that. Any of the major rivers are. Now, if they don't have a dam on it, it is not this. But what we're speaking of is creeks, canals, other ways for water to get across US 41. Every canal has to be dammed off with a dam, a weir, a culvert, something, to keep salt water on one side and the fresh water on the other. Keeps the fresh water fresh, it keeps the salt water saltier. But now where the term brackish comes in is when the fresh water goes into the saltwater area. You have too much fresh water, flows over the dam, goes into the saltwater canals, and reduces the salinity. Now, the term brackish water, brackish comes from the Dutch word brack, or salty. This started back in England around 1500. Now, keeping in mind, the Dutch conquered / Vikings conquered Canada, the U.S., Greenland, Iceland, England. They controlled a lot of different places. So that a Dutch word is very likely to be, the English used a derivative of Dutch words, mispronounced them, respelled them, to come up with the words. But B-A-R-K is the Dutch term for salty. So they thought they were drinking fresh water, and oh, that's salty, that's brack. Brackish water. That's where it came from. In the 1500s, England utilizing the Dutch term for salty. And all it means is fresh water that's salty. And it's not ocean water, it's not river water, it's fresh water that's a little salty. So that's where it comes from. But the hard thing to remember is the law makes no difference.
No, they don't recognize it at all.
You can't go, okay, I got a freshwater license, I'm in brackish water, that's not salt water. No, that's salt water. You have to have a saltwater license to fish in brackish water. You have to have a freshwater license to fish in saltwater. So,
and freshwater license to fish in freshwater.
Freshwater license to fish in freshwater. Saltwater license to fish in brackish or salt. But as soon as you got salt in it, and it's in, the easiest way to tell if there's Gulf of Mexico, Charlotte Harbor, canal, if there's no dam between where you're fishing and the Gulf of Mexico, that's saltwater.
Correct.
If there's a dam, a weir, a culvert, or whatever, nope, that's probably freshwater.
Right. And most of the time you'll know it because it'll say, like, harbor access or saltwater access most of the time. There are some occasions where you've got small little levees that you have to go from one side of the freshwater dam to the saltwater side. But, you know, if somebody tells you it's a brackish canal, it's a saltwater canal.
Now, do we put him to the test with that statement and ask him where has he seen this?
What?
You just said sometimes there's a little levee or something like that. What are you talking about?
Like on Shell Creek.
A lift. Okay.
You're as bad as me.
You think one thing and say something else.
I learned from you.
Yeah, I know. That's true.
And to think I was so impressed with the Dutch lesson.
Yeah. Well, where did the name snook come from?
Oh, where did snook come from?
The Dutch word for pike. S-N-O-E-K.
Oh, wow. Never would have guessed that.
Yeah, it just threw me. I'm just really surprised. But I'm not surprised. They're my ancestors, my heritage. You know, my family has influenced the world. We've named snook. We've done brackish water. That us Dutch boys, we rock.
We should have got you. We should have got you boys in the FWC. And maybe it would have made some sense.
Yeah, well, who knows? All right.
It's just a confusing one for a lot of people because especially people that live in the Midwest, there is no salt water. It's just everything is always fresh water.
Yeah.
And then you come down into the saltwater environment, and then they cross over. People say, well, it's brackish canal, and that confuses you. So is it freshwater? Is it saltwater? The biggest thing is that 90%, well, probably more than that, probably at least 90% of our freshwater species, both native and non-native, cannot live in salt water. Versus our saltwater fish, a lot of our species can live in freshwater.
Almost all of them. Now, the difference is, boys and girls, let's put on our thinking cap. We've got the chalkboard out. We're taking a line and we're drawing it across the freshwater-saltwater area. If you are a freshwater fish and you dare to cross that line, you get into the salt will burn your gills out and you will die. But if you're a saltwater fish choosing to cross over into the freshwater, well, you've got quite a bit of time before you got to get out of there because you have salt in your body and you can assume minerals and stuff. Actually, a lot of the fresh water in Florida has so many minerals in it, which actually do include salt, that most of the saltwater fish like snook, redfish, even sheephead and several others have no trouble living in a lot of our ponds, lakes, and stuff like that, mostly due to the mineral count. The amount of minerals that are in it, which amongst those minerals is a fair amount of salt. Very light, you wouldn't be able to read it on a meter, but just enough to keep those fish alive. The reason we don't have more saltwater species spawning in saltwater and getting into bigger numbers is saltwater fish need to spawn in saltwater where the eggs can float. The difference in the buoyancy between saltwater and freshwater is the reason most saltwater fish don't successfully spawn in freshwater because the eggs sink to the bottom in freshwater. There's not enough buoyancy in it to hold the eggs up, and so most of them die. Very high mortality rate.
Right, and the biggest thing is our saltwater fish don't build nests. You know, they don't build a nest and guard them and protect their eggs, so they rely on the tides and the currents
to disperse their eggs
to protected habitat versus freshwater fish. Almost all of them build some type of nest, lay their eggs, and protect it.
Okay, well, we've drawn down about brackish water enough. I'm sure everybody's bored with it now. This water temperature, Carl said it dropped 8 degrees yesterday, surface temperatures. It's down to about 63, I think, right?
Yeah.
So with a 63-degree harbor, does that mean no cobia? Does that mean, sir, we have no cobia? This is the question before the court. I need to know.
I'm going to say that there's still going to be some around, but the afternoon fishing form is probably going to be better than the early morning fishing form.
I'm going to say absolutely, but I have seen like 4 pictures in the last week of cobia up to 60 pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, from the 40s and 50-inch range, no problem. Big, big cobia. And over the last, I would say, week. Before that, I was seeing pictures of cobia, but the guys were letting them go. They were too small.
Right.
And over this last week, massive amounts. Big cobia coming in. Guys are either catching them, hooking them, seeing them, lot of big cobia. I'm having a brain contusion where the gaseous materials in the intestine has bubbled up my spinal column, hit the base of my brain, and made it impossible to think. Is this normal, cobia in this cold of water?
No. Honestly, not under normal situations. I've not heard of this many cobia being caught in basically late November, early to mid-December, the way we have this year. There's always a handful around, but not where these guys are actually...
This is exceptional cobia fishing.
These guys are targeting them and catching them.
Pretty much unheard of for this time of year.
Yeah, it's usually a March, April thing. Now, especially March, but even sometimes late February. But March is usually that beginning of it.
Yeah, they're just, for some reason, they're here now. RJ, you're an old sports writer, outdoor guy. I mean, you've been doing this forever and ever. Your opinion, normal, not normal?
My suspicion is the water temperatures dropped really fast this year. All of a sudden, we got these cold fronts that have come through. It's what, the third one now or the fourth one? And the water temperatures dropped really fast, so it didn't, I don't think it moved the fish out. I think eventually it's going to move them out, but I think they're here, the water temperature dropped, and they're still here.
So you think the water temperatures fell so fast, they just didn't have time to get out of Dodge?
That'd be my guess, because normally the water temperatures drop relatively slowly in this area, you know, as it starts to get cooler and cooler, and it stimulates the fish to leave. As the temperature's getting colder, then they go out. We've had these cold fronts come through, and they've been coming through from the northwest.
Yeah.
Right? So it's probably pushing cold water in front of it.
So, yeah, it's just one of those things. And the other weird part about it is we had almost 10-degree drop in surface temperatures overnight, not so much because of the overnight, but because of yesterday and the overnight. The cloud cover yesterday did not allow the sun to heat that water up all day. So it's the cooling trend actually started with the cloud cover, the rainy conditions and all that. When you have that colder rain dropping, the cloud cover, and then polish it off with a 40-degree night, that's where you get that cold water drop from. And that first foot of water would have gone very cold in the last 24 hours.
Yeah.
Now, 4 feet down hasn't changed much, but that surface where we're reading it with our boats, huge drop in temperature. Now, that could be the reason we've had that massive drop on the surface waters, but did it really change anything 4 to 6 feet down? Just starting to get a little bit cool down there.
I think it's making a better impact on it right now just because of the strong winds that we had for 2.5 days fully, and last night it stayed pretty darn windy all night long on top of the low tide that it was already at, and then the wind blowing it out even lower. We've had a lot of exposed dirt the last day and a half, 2 days, so that chills that down, and that's basically equivalent to putting, you know, slightly chilled surface temperature, but then taking an ice cube and putting it down on the bottom of your glass. It sometimes can keep that water temperature from raising back up as quick. Like back in late October, early November, when we had that first cold front come through, surface temperature dropped, you know, 4, 5, 6 degrees in a matter of 2 days, but in a day and a half, it was back up that 5 or 6 degrees.
All right.
This blow, I think, is going to make it a longer-term effect for it to try to creep back up.
I'm going to drop back to sheephead for just a second. Fiddler crabs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we get a lot of fiddler crabs at the store. You know, we got to go back through and remodel the tank. It doesn't seem to be a big year for fiddler crabs on the sheephead. What do you think people are... Are either you guys seen anybody using something unusual, something whatever? Because normally we're going through gazillions of sheephead, and we're selling a bit of them.
Right.
But, you know, hundreds a day, not thousands.
Right. I think one of the biggest problems is that the last 2 years they have been hard to get throughout the whole state. I think a lot of people are realizing that you can catch them on frozen shrimp. You can catch them on live shrimp. You can catch them on fish bites. You know, they're finding other alternatives that are working, so I think some of these guys have kind of started to stick with some of that because they realize they don't have to worry about a bucket. They don't have to keep them alive. They got this other alternative. If they can get the fiddler crabs, it's an added bonus.
All right. RJ, Opinion? No opinion?
I'm not sure. I've been seeing a lot of fiddler crabs this year in the ditches around the Myakka River. You know, way more than I normally see, so it must be good breeding time for them.
I'm hearing a lot of people catching crabs to use for bait.
Yeah, no, there's a lot, and they basically fill the ditches. I mean, there's so many of them, so it shouldn't be hard to get in there with a net and pull them out.
I'm just lazy. I just want to go ahead, go give me 24. I'm going fishing.
Yeah, but going back to the Eljo Bean Fishing Pier wisdom, I think a lot of the guys there are using frozen shrimp.
Okay, what makes you? Is that what you're seeing now?
That's what I'm seeing. You know, as I walk down the pier to see what's going on and I'm talking to people, they're mostly using shrimp, either frozen shrimp or a few of them had live shrimp.
Now, my favorite thing, if I'm going to use frozen shrimp on sheephead, is I take the head off, I put it on the railing, I peel the shell, set it there. I want to use that as kind of a chump. So I'm going to wait, get my bait in the water, then kind of take my knife, crush that up, and scrape all that right down to where I'm fishing. So all the little pieces of head, and I peel the shell off, just like I would if I was going to eat it. I want to thread it on the hook so the hook is entirely covered with that soft meat, and the point of the hook is just barely sticking out. So they're not seeing that hook. It's entirely in the soft meat of the shrimp body, and it's all peeled, ready to eat. And they like that soft meat because that's why they're eating the barnacles, not because they want that hard part, because they want that soft little worm on the inside.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's very true. You know, and I like to actually set my frozen shrimp on the railing for a few minutes and kind of let it dry out just a little bit. It gets a little bit more rubbery, a little bit more tacky. So they have it gives me that extra little bit of extra half a second to maybe set the hook on those fish, because I am not the best sheep's head fisherman.
And it's almost impossible to thread a shrimp tail, you know, a natural shrimp tail on a circle hook.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible. So the best rule of thumb, as we've always said, if using J hooks on sheephead, set the hook right before you leave the house, and that should be about the right time for when you get out there.
It just takes practice and time, because a lot of people do get frustrated with it and think they're doing something wrong. And it literally is just go out and try it and be patient and practice at it a lot. You will dial it in.
Okay, monoliter, fluorocarbon liter. We are talking about sheephead, but I'm going to expand this out. And we're going to expand, and the question is going to be steel leader, monoliter, or fluorocarbon leader, any fish, any range, whatever you feel like. Robert, what do you need fluorocarbon? Can you use steel or mono?
I'm almost always going to go with mono or fluorocarbon for my leader. I very seldom use steel leader at all. This time of year, though, with the water getting as clear as it is, in some areas, fluorocarbon will make a pretty darn difference in the amount of bites you're going to get.
Okay, but you said, and I'm going to utilize this point or go to this point with you, you almost always use monofilament leader, not fluorocarbon.
Well, I said mono or fluorocarbon, not steel.
Oh, I thought you said mono.
No, okay. Mono just was the first one in the sentence. I very seldom use steel leader for anything. I'm almost always going with some type of plastic-based leader.
Okay, mono or fluorocarbon.
Yeah.
RJ, you steel, mono, fluorocarbon. What are you going for?
The discussion has always been, oh, fluorocarbon is so expensive.
That's your discussion. Well, I just go over, grab the fluorocarbon and go.
Well, that's you know, my opinion.
That's your.
Just go get the fluorocarbon.
That's the attorney in you coming out.
Yeah, you're only using 20 inches at a time, so, you know, how bad can this be? Go buy the fluorocarbon, and you don't have to worry about whether the water's got tannin in it or it's crystal clear or whatever. And I'll go with Robert on the steel leader, on the wire leaders, with one exception. I try not ever to use them unless I'm going after something with a lot of teeth. And I use a black steel leader. That seems to have worked much better for me than a standard steel leader where you can get a little bit of sunlight glinting off of it.
Okay, so you're again a monofluorocarbon guy.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, the question is now, do you guys, do you think it's mono? Robert, when would you use mono? And RJ, I'm going to get to you with when would you do fluorocarbon?
Honestly, I'm going to use mono when I'm fishing at night. And also, if the water is extremely churned up, like if I'm beach fishing and we've had this northwest wind and the waves have been pounding on the beach, it's milky colored. Visibility is not very much at all. So I'm going to use regular mono leader. And then, especially in the summertime when we have a lot of tannins in the water's got about 2 inches of visibility, if that, I'm going to use a mono leader.
Okay. RJ, what do you got? Fluorocarbon, when, why, or just all the time?
Well, you know, what fluorocarbon does for me is I don't have to worry about what's the visibility in the water. So I just go with the fluorocarbon leader.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I'm going to agree with both of you. I haven't found a huge amount of difference between using just regular mono leader and the fluorocarbon leader pretty much at any point, because I spent so many years as a charter boat guy before fluorocarbon came out catching fish with mono. So I've done it with steel, I've done it with mono, I've done it with fluorocarbon. I will say today it's a little more competitive, getting that little extra edge to use the fluorocarbon. The only difference between fluorocarbon and mono is that fluorocarbon is supposed to bend light the same way as water does. So as the light passes through water, it should pass through your fluorocarbon leader the exact same way. Quite often, when you look at it as a human with a human eye, you'll almost look like a hollow black tube going through the water. It doesn't appear like line, it doesn't appear like anything, but I've seen it actually in the salt water where it actually looks like almost like a black hole going through the water. I mean, it's just like nothing there.
Yeah.
And so I've never seen mono do that exactly. And what I'm wondering about, and what I think about, is if you put color in fluorocarbon, is it really fluorocarbon? I'm going to say no. The Ozuri pink is not really fluorocarbon. The brown from, I think, Pure Fit Berkeley has a brown. The multicolor from High Seas. Are they really fluorocarbon in the true sense of the word? Fluorocarbon is made to bend light the same way as the water. If you put pink on it, you put brown on it, you put multicolors in it, it cannot bend light the same way as water does. So basically, you're overpaying for what should have just been done with monofilament, in my opinion. If they would have done it on a much less expensive monofilament, I could still use the pink, the brown, or the multicolor. I don't believe there would be a difference. Now, I'm going to go to you, RJ. You think that once you add the color, is that really giving you the benefits of fluorocarbon?
I don't think so. I think adding the color is so the fisherman can see where the line is, but it also means the fish can see where the line is, too. So that one never made any sense to me, why you would buy colored fluorocarbon.
Well, I can tell you, the pink is my favorite color leader for snook fishing. If I'm going out strictly to target snook, I like having that pink leader. I've caught so many big fish with it. I never use it any other time, but most of the time, if I'm going to go out snook fishing and I'm going to be throwing lures, I've got two rods with me, one with a clear leader on it, usually nowadays fluorocarbon because I want every edge I can get, but the other one has the pink leader on it. I think it makes a hell of a difference, and it could be just confidence level. I've done it so much. Probably doesn't make a damn bit of difference one way or another.
And it may also be, what is the snook able to see as far as color range is concerned?
Bingo!
And you know, we're looking at it with a human eye, and we've got a pretty wide range of color that we can see. What is a fish see? Well, maybe snook don't see pink.
Well, how do we know how they see the colors?
Well, you know, paint something pink and throw it in front of him and see if he sees it or not.
Well, they eat jig heads that are pink. They eat tails that are pink, and they'll eat lures that are pink.
No, wait, Robert, well, you had a great point the other day. You almost passed over. Robert was talking to a guy in the shop, and he said, well, you know, this pink is a big deal right now, especially with the cold weather, because a shrimp will lay on the bottom. Now, what were you telling me? Same about the shrimp.
Well, like a lot of people think about some of these funky colors of some of the baits, whether it's a weird yellow or ugly green or pink in particular. And I was explaining to the customer that, like, this time of year when the water temperatures drop drastically, shrimp bury themselves during the daytime because they're nocturnal critters and everything wants to eat them. So they actually hide under the sand. Well, they're cold-blooded like anything else, and if they sense a real major change in the weather, they could stay buried in that sand for several days. Well, what happens is their exoskeleton actually can get damaged from either sitting for too long or because the sand actually gets chilled enough to actually damage their body, like basically frostbite. And that piece starts to die off. Well, when it's starting to die and decompose, it's changing colors. We get shrimp in sometimes with orangish colored tails or pink tails.
And these shrimp are alive. They're perfectly fine. But as Robert said, part of their tail meat is actually rotting, and they're still alive going along. I mean, it'd be kind of like the equivalent of, like you said, frostbite, where you have a foot and it's all black and weird colors, but you're still going along.
Well, how many dogs and cats get their leg amputated and they still function fine or damaged or whatever? So it's the same thing.
People, look at Steve at the store. He's missing a leg. You know, he does real good.
Exactly.
He's got more energy than I do. So here, that brings you into the pink thing. I just thought that was a pretty neat point he made.
It is. It's a really good point.
Where the shrimp lay there and literally parts of them get damaged and they're dying. They're turning all these different colors.
And how that conversation came up from the beginning part of it was he was looking for the banana jigs, the pompano, silly willy jigs, whatever you want to call them. Why was pink such a good color and why do they come in so many weird colors? And I explained to him that sand fleas are a real popular food source for pompano out on the beach, along with other fish. And sand fleas, when they have their egg case on the bottom of them, just like a lobster or a crab or anything else, they actually start off kind of a greenish color. Then they turn to a slightly weirdish yellowish color. Then they go to almost like a hunter safety orange color. And even a little bit of a pink hue to them. So different stages of the development of their eggs under their belly change colors versus, like, the only time I've ever seen, like, crabs or lobster, it's always like a black, bluish-black color.
Mm-hmm.
But sand fleas, I've seen them where it's like a almost safety orange color on their belly. So maybe that's why those fish are more directed towards those certain colors.
Right. Let me make a comment on late, too. And this just came up this Thanksgiving. I was talking to one of my old diving buddies. And he said, go into a dark room, take your lure, and then light the lure with your telephone, with your cell phone, because it's a blue light that's coming out of your cell phone. All LED screens are emitting blue light. And as you get deeper and deeper in the water column, you get more and more blue light. Actually, you're getting less and less of all the other colors until just blue remains.
Blue ultraviolet.
Right, and he's saying that's what fish see when they look at that color you're looking at in the air. When it gets down about 3, 5, 7, 10 feet, you got more and more blue light, and so that's what it looks like to the fish. And I haven't tried that yet, but I'm going to.
What is it? So you would do it with your camera. You would be turning on your camera, holding the lure in front of you, looking at it through your camera in a dark room.
You could do that too, but also he was just saying hold your phone with the screen lit over the top of the lure in a dark room.
So just using the light of the screen.
Any light coming from an LED screen is blue.
But not like the flashlight part of your phone.
Now that's going to be white.
That's going to be white.
The flashlight's going to be white. The LED screen itself is going to be...
But like if you were going to call somebody who just had the screen on, like with the...
The first
thing that comes up, it's blue light. So let that shine over and see what happens.
Yeah, so we'll report back to you boys and girls next week as to what we find out when we do that.
I mean, I'm going to because, I mean, I've laid underwater and had people throwing lures over the top of me so I can see what they look like. I sit there and have people work lures to the side of me, above me. I've been in the water watching how all this stuff works so I could get kind of an idea of it. But I still don't think human eyes and fish eyes see colors the same way, because at 80 feet, humans are not seeing hardly any colors at all.
Right.
80 feet down. They're pretty much down to basically blue, but you could not tell the difference between pink and a shade of gray. A human could not.
Right.
But fish sure as heck do. They can see the pink, the blue and silver. They somehow or another, one color can do better out there than the other colors. Well, and they must see them, and there's not enough light for human.
Right, and it has to do with the way the fish's eye lens works also. Like, there's a couple of fish, like the bluefish, that can see as well out of water as they can in the water. But a lot of fish, when you take them out of the water, they don't see, there's no focus for them anymore. They don't, where a bluefish, when you go reach down to get that hook out, he can see your fingers coming.
Yeah, that, and he's just got a mean attitude.
Right, that too, right.
They were born and bred in that Northeast. They have the attitude.
Right, so some fish have the ability to see out of water, but they're fairly few and far between. So their whole eye structure is different. The rods and cones and all the rest of it are different than ours. So we shouldn't be looking at something and saying, that looks cool. We should be looking at it and say, what does the fish see when he sees that?
And that's my point. That's why I've tried to get in the water. I've used a mask. I've done it without a mask. Because as soon as you put on a diving mask, everything underwater changes. Mm-hmm. You take the mask off, and your eyes are trying to focus with the bend of the water,
right.
Where with the mask, you're looking through air and then in the water. Everything makes a difference. So we talked that there's a bunch of Kobe around. There's a lot of trout around. Trout on the east side, Lemon Bay, Pirate Harbor, Pine Island Sound. I mean, it's harder to find bigger ones. Already, the larger ones are getting a little more scarce, but you can do it. A little bit bigger bait, a little deeper down. The smaller ones are going to be more active, more closer to the surface. A lot of cobia in the area. Robert, cobia baits?
Cobia baits, honestly, I'd be throwing a 3-inch shad tail. That's been working really good for a lot of these guys that are finding them. And then the other guys that have been catching them on pinfish, putting pinfish on a bobber.
Now, are you down 6 feet on a bobber? You down 2 feet? Down a foot?
If they're fishing out around the reefs or one of the channel markers where some of these fish have been coming from, I'm going to be doing it about 3 to 5 feet below the bobber. And then I'm also going to go to a little bit shallower bobber if I'm, say, around one of the sandbars. You know, if I'm on the outer edge of a bar and say 4 to 6 feet of water, I'm going to set that bobber at about 2 to 3 feet and see what comes along and grabs it.
Okay. Now, I'm just going to have kind of a big gold spoon, like a 1 ounce or 3/4 ounce gold spoon tied on. Just because, A, they're usually a little further away than I can cast. B, a lot of bright, flashy spoon. I don't know why, but even when I'm in clear water and I'm going for cobia, I like the gold. I know if I'm on the Gulf, I should still do the silver. But I've thrown that gold at cobia and really have them. I think my personal thing, now I don't know if this is true, but to me, I just think they follow and hit gold better than they do silver.
Yeah, and I can see that, but I understand the reason for the spoon, because a spoon is so much more versatile than, say, just a bucktail. You can change your speed and slow your rate of sinking down with a spoon much better than you can with, say, a bucktail or just a plain old jig head. I like the idea of a spoon to pitch at them.
Now, I'm going to go with at least 40-pound test, mono or fluorocarbon. If I got that big a spoon on, I am going to try and get 50 or 60-pound leader material on there. I still might be fighting them with 20-pound test braid, but that heavier leader material is going to give me more time to land the fish. And if I got 50 or 60-pound fluorocarbon on there with a 3/4 ounce or a 1 ounce spoon and the fish hits, for some reason or other, a cobia is one of those weird fish. You're bringing him up next to the boat. You got to put him in the landing net because he gets real dumb, comes real close real quick. And all it is a circus trick because he goes right through the hoop and right out the back of the net. And now your line is trapped through that landing net. And you got to figure out how to hold that landing net up, get it up, take it over your rod, get it out of the way, because the fish ain't coming back to do it for you.
Right.
He's just up there swimming around. You just got him to do a circus trick. And their biggest circus trick is jumping right through a landing net, putting holes in them, and making them go away.
Yeah, yeah, they have a way of doing that, you know, and they don't have a lot of teeth, you know, as far as like sharp teeth, but they do have some fairly good chompers on them. And having that heavier leader line on there, because the fight is usually quite a bit of time, allows for that abrasion as they're wearing through it. Because with 30-pound or 40-pound, they can wear through it pretty good, especially if you get into one of those 30-plus-pound fish.
Well, I'm figuring if I'm pulling with 20-pound test and I got 60-pound leader on, he can wear two-thirds of the leader away before I'm down to my line strength.
Right.
So he can sit there and chew on it, rub on it, do whatever, but he can go through more than half of that leader, I'm still good.
Right.
I still have 20 pounds worth of pulling pressure.
No, that makes sense. I didn't think about that aspect of it, too.
Okay.
Having that line like that, I mean, you, some instances you want that heavier leader line, you know, to be much heavier than your main fishing line, so you can put that added pressure to them and also that added length of the fight.
If you're pulling, if you got 20-pound test on, having 60 pounds of pulling pressure means nothing.
No.
It just doesn't exist. You still only got 20 of pulling pressure. But what you do get is time to use the 20 pounds of pull you do have.
Right.
They can chew through it, wear through it. And in this instance, 60 into 20, they can do two-thirds of it. More than half can be chewed away, and I'm still golden. Now, getting into snook fishing right now, there's a gazillion snook out there. Up the river, 49-inch snook. The canals, 40-inch snook. Down to like 12-inch. The east side of the harbor, 9-10-inch snook all the way on up through into the middle 30s. West side of the harbor, more 30-inch fish on the west side of the harbor as far as snook fishing goes. Shrimp is quickly becoming the bait to use. White bait is not better than shrimp right now. Shrimp is better than white bait. The closer you are to 60 degrees, the more shrimp is your perfect bait. It's better than pinfish, better than white bait. Once you get up about 75, white bait is the best bait you can use. But saying this is the best bait is just foolishness. It is the best bait for the temperature. It is the best bait for the time of year. Right now it's about shrimp. Get some choice selects, hand picks, go out. You are going to catch your snook. You're going to catch your redfish. This is your primary bait. Crabs are secondary to shrimp at this point. You've got to change the baits as the weather conditions, as the color conditions, the water conditions. All this changes during the year. If you're a person, this is the only bait you use because that's the bait you want to use. Well, it's good you like going fishing because you're not actually going out to do any catching. If you're a person who likes to go out and do catching rather than just fishing, you're going to change your bait to when shrimp is the best, to when white bait's the best, when pinfish is the best, when dead bait's the best. Right now, live shrimp, your king number one bait. It's not that way all the time, but right now it is.
Absolutely.
And that's the one thing we have a hard time explaining to people is there is no perfect bait. Shrimp is the bottom of the food chain for everything else. But they also want to eat crabs. They want to eat fiddler crabs, blue crabs. They want pinfish. They want white bait. They want ladyfish. They want mullet. And mullets start out tiny microscopic. They're not a two-foot fish when they're born.
They aren't born instantly jumping out of the, into the air?
No. They're literally born microscopic and get bigger. And as they're getting bigger, everything's feeding on mullet. It is one of the best baits out there. So, but right now, the truth of the matter is, as that water temperature is 58 to 63 degrees, this range, 60 is the range, shrimp is the king of baits because it moves slower. Fish can actually, and we're going to talk about this a little bit next week, the fish can actually rot inside the fish's belly. If the water's too cold and the fish eats certain things, it can literally kill them because they cannot digest it. They can still digest the shrimp. So that's kind of where we're at with that.
Now, we got 1 minute left, and we do have a question that came in by email.
All right.
Somebody wants to know, how is the cold weather and cold water affecting red tide?
Is it 29 degrees out?
No.
Then it's not going to affect red tide.
Okay.
So
the cold weather is not our salvation as far as red tide is concerned.
Nothing to do with anything, because unless it's cold enough to kill a plant, getting chilly, I'm going to assume the red tide's uncomfortable. But
they got their little sweaters on.
Yeah, they got their little sweaters on. The red tide algaes are out there doing that. But it's got to be 32 degrees to kill a lot of plants. They actually have to have a frost. Now, look at your houseplants. If it's not killing your houseplant, it ain't killing the red tide. Just because it's uncomfortable doesn't mean it's deadly. And in order for it to have an effect on the red tide, it has to be deadly. 32 degrees or less. Ain't seen it yet. Now, the red tide's uncomfortable. It's going to have to put a swatter on, but it ain't going to matter at this point.
No, it can slow down the growth rate of it a little bit, but it won't stop it
at all. It's probably not going to bloom.
So we've dispelled that myth.
Yes.
Sorry. Wish it was. Fish and Frank here. Robert in the chair across from me. And the captain and commander, RJ, in the control center. Bye. We'll see you next week. I wish the red tide did die from a little bit of cool, but it's got to be cold. Just to ease my mind.